of Caracas.
This is a specialized meeting on the latest studies on the coronavirus. Organized and hosted by Bacalhau University, the event brought together epidemiologists, virologists, and other medical experts to present their team's latest findings on prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
We tried the so-called plasmapheresis in treating COVID-19 patients. What is plasmapheresis? It's a method of removing blood plasma from the body and re-injecting it into the bloodstream. We conducted this method on 28 COVID patients and it was effective so far. We need to gather a large sample to achieve more reliable results.
We conducted a single-centered retrospective observational study of 60 laboratory-confirmed COVID patients and administered low-dose prednisolone in combination with naproxen and lopinavir. This helped reduce the length of patients' hospitalization.
Since the pandemic broke out in Iran, Bagayatullah University has dedicated its R&D centers to COVID-related projects. So far, it has launched 200 research projects that seek to find a way to tackle the pandemic. Among them is a recombinant-based COVID vaccine that is making its way to the human trial phase.
We are wrapping up the animal trial stage and will soon begin the human trials of our vaccine. Our university has become a hotspot of major projects that center on COVID-19. We were amongst the first center that proposed plasma therapy for COVID-19. We're also conducting research on stem cell therapy and other viable treatments for the novel disease.
With the Bagayatullah vaccine, Iran now possesses three viable candidates that have made their way to the human trial. Covfars, which is a recombinant vaccine, and Coviran, which works based on a weakened coronavirus. This, as Iran has already started its mass inoculation program using Russia's Sputnik V.
Bagayatullah Hospital has since day one been one of the most active places in the fight against COVID-19. Now as many biotech firms are concentrating their efforts on prevention and vaccine development, this center has also paid attention to treatment. Researchers here say they're very close to an effective COVID medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans that make nearly a third of the population might have been infected with the coronavirus. Nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far. Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The passage of time will never let the world forget the war crimes former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein committed against the innocent Iranian people. As part of its heinous crimes, the Iraqi dictator bombarded northwestern city of Sardash in 1978, killing 119 innocent civilians and exposing more than 8,000 to toxic gases, which maimed them forever. But Saddam was not alone in this 8-year war, and there were several countries, including Germany, France, the UK, and the US, that assisted him by arming his regime by chemical weapons. The Islamic Republic has always stressed that those complicit in Saddam's war crimes must be brought to justice. Therefore, in the presence of the country's top officials, an international conference was held in Tehran to look into the legal and international claims of the Islamic Republic in this regard.
Many countries gave Saddam intelligence, political, economic, military, and media support. All the world witnessed that these countries all stood against the great nation of Iran, but the United Nations could not play its role. The UN did not declare the Iraqi regime as the aggressor and the perpetrator of war. This is the question that the international community must ask the UN. Why the Security Council did not stop the aggressor from committing crimes against the Islamic Republic.
In the face of the chemical attacks, the international community turned down Tehran's frequent requests for deployment of experts for field investigations, something that Iran's foreign minister blasted during this event.
The Iraqi regime used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and non-civilians, and also the Iraqi people. In 6 or 7 reports by the United Nations, it was declared that the chemical weapons were first used against military forces and then civilians. But the United Nations does not have a good record in supporting international law, and during the imposed war, it did not even use the means to make power balance.
It was also stressed at this conference that the assassination of the former Iranian IRGC Quds Force Commander General Qasem Soleimani is top on the agenda to be followed up as part of this plan.
Thinkers and researchers from 17 countries presented their papers on the legal aspects of the imposed war on Iran. These experts, in both virtual and in-person methods, elaborated on how the foreign countries helped Saddam's regime in killing civilians. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argued that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
The Gaza Strip began its coronavirus vaccination campaign using the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Medical workers will be the first to receive the jabs. The vaccination comes after long delays by the Israeli regime that only allowed a small shipment of the vaccine to reach Gaza last Thursday, after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations. Another shipment of the Russian vaccine arrived then through the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing on Sunday.
Today, we begin the vaccination of COVID-19 in the Gaza Strip, and God willing, we will be able to control the spread of the deadly virus and have herd immunity.
Nearly 55,000 people in the blockaded Gaza Strip have been infected with the coronavirus, mostly since late August 2020. Some 550 Gazans have also died of COVID-19.
The Gaza Strip is one of the most overpopulated areas in the world. Vaccination will play a major role in preventing the coronavirus pandemic and lowering the number of deaths in case we can manage to inoculate people as soon as possible. First doses would go to frontline medical workers, vulnerable patients, and the elderly.
Local authorities in the Gaza Strip struggled for months to lower the coronavirus infection rates through strict measures. The Israeli blockade has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
This vaccination campaign is one of the main measures of the Ministry of Health to control the spread of this pandemic, along with other protocols. This vaccine will give immunity to those who receive it, and in turn will lower the number of daily infections.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices under the watchful eye of the international community.
As vaccination begins in the blockaded enclave, experts say Tel Aviv must end its illegal policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing proper medical care. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee, I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden ordered military airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. The military action, the first of its kind under U.S. President Joe Biden, has been met with negative reactions, with many observers likening Biden's approach to that of his hawkish predecessor, Donald Trump. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. Iran has repeatedly rejected any role in the attacks targeting American bases in Iraq. Iraqi resistance forces have been fighting remnants of the Takfiri-Daesh terror group across border regions of Iraq and Syria in coordination with the governments in both Arab countries. Damascus has censured the U.S. air raid, describing it as cowardly and a bad sign from the new U.S. administration. For more on that story, we're joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who's with us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Mohammed, one more details you have to share with us and our viewers.
Yes, the Syrian Foreign Ministry issued a statement on this development, saying that Syria strongly condemns what it described as the cowardly U.S. aggression on Deir ez-Zor Governorate, particularly areas on the Syrian-Iraqi borderline, warning that the aggression would lead to consequences that escalate the region, the entire region over here. Also, the Foreign Ministry added that the aggression is a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter. The Foreign Ministry's statement also said that this aggression is a negative sign of the policies of the new U.S. administration, which should abide by international legitimacy, not by the law of the jungle, according to the statement of the foreign ministry. The foreign ministry also demanded the United States to change its aggressive policies towards Syria and stop supporting and investing in various terrorist organizations across the Arab country. The foreign ministry referred also that recently the United States, U.S. forces in Syria transported hundreds of Daesh terrorists, for example, from prisons under the control of the SDF, the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, to its base, illegal base, of course, in Al-Tanf area on the Syrian-Iraqi borders. It is to be mentioned that the United States' presence is illegal in Syria without a UN mandate, without the authorization of the Syrian government. The United States and the U.S.-led coalition carried out in the past years dozens of airstrikes that killed hundreds of Syrian civilians, destroyed the infrastructure, and also destroyed public and private property. And finally, in the statement, the foreign ministry called on the United Nations to shoulder its responsibilities in preserving international peace and security and take swift action to stop one of its permanent member states, which is the United States, from carrying on its crimes and aggression on a sovereign country like Syria.
All right, thanks a lot, Mohammed Ali, joining us from Damascus. Our guest for this debate, Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, we have a national co-director of the International Action Center, Ms. Sarah Flounders, joining us from New York. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. Mr. Kovalik, what does this attack say about U.S. President Joe Biden's approach to foreign policy?
Well, I think it says what many of us feared, and that is that he is going to be a very aggressive president when it comes to military action. You mentioned at the outset of the broadcast, you compared him to his hawkish predecessor, Trump. I'm not sure Trump was any more hawkish than Obama, and I'm not sure Biden will be less hawkish than Trump. My guess is he'll actually be more so. And this is a signal of that. This is an unlawful attack he engaged in. It's illegal under international law. There was no security authorization for it. It wasn't done as an act of self-defense. And it was a war crime. So I think he's signaling, you know, he keeps saying America's back. And what he means by that is the 82nd Airborne is back to start bombing people. And that's a shame.
Sarah Flounders, what do you think is behind the decision to carry out this attack?
Well, I think, as was just said, President Biden is really sending a message that not to expect anything different than previous U.S. presidents in terms of criminal, illegal activity. It's an absolute war crime. I mean, the U.S. has no business being in Syria, has no business being in the region at all. They use the flimsiest excuse that's even imaginable, that an Iraqi resistance group backed by Iran, all of this supposed, and for that reason they're bombing Syria. I mean, even here in the U.S., how on earth is that understandable to anyone? But it's saying that the U.S. needs no excuse to continue its intervention. The U.S. has been bombing Syria since 2014, and from the very beginning was part of this effort to bring down Syria, to destroy Syria, to pull it apart from 2011, a regime change operation is what they called it. And this is Biden signaling that there is no real change in policy. It shows enormous hostility. Also, it's openly said this is to be a message to Iran. It's to be a message to Iraq. It's to a message also to the people here in the U.S. who had expectations about Biden, that maybe he would speak for Amazon workers who are desperately trying to organize a union, more than a million low-wage workers at stake, one warehouse they're organizing. Biden won't say a word, won't say a word. They're still waiting for a stimulus bill here for millions and millions of people who are desperate. But they could carry out, at enormous expense, a bombing run in Syria. And that is criminal toward the people of Syria, but it's also criminal toward the people here in the U.S. who needed and expected that there would be some change. And of course, there's not.
Daniel, Damascus has censured the U.S. air raid, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new U.S. president. What do you think would be the fallout from this attack?
Well, I think that any chance of the nuclear deal with Iran being put back in place between the U.S. and Iran, I think that's – there was slim hope of that anyway, given Biden's position on that, but I think now – that's probably finished. And I think that he, by this bombing, wanted to send the message that there's no rapprochement with Iran coming from him. He sent that message loud and clear, and so, and I'm sure Iran got the message that, again, it's going to be business as usual between the U.S. and Iran, which means sanctions are going to stay in place, which means ordinary Iranians are going to continue to suffer. So that's going to be one fallout. I think a lot of the world, even in Europe, is going to be more wary of the Biden administration. I think there were some amongst world leaders who hoped he would be more diplomatic than Trump, that he would use peaceful means to try to deal with conflicts with other countries. And in fact, Biden, you know, said so, that he would use peaceful means first to deal with other countries. And what he's shown by his actions is he has no intention of doing that. He is going to shoot first and ask questions later.
Sarah Flounders, hours after the U.S. attack, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, along with his Syrian counterpart, they both emphasize the need for Western countries to abide by U.N. Security Council resolutions regarding Syria. The question is the law. It hasn't really been a concern for Washington, especially when it comes to Syria, has it?
This is so absolutely lawless. There's no concern for even a fig leaf of cover on this, not at all. And we should just keep in mind that the U.S., with no justification, has absolutely made every effort to stop Syria from rebuilding. After these 10 years of hugely destructive war, Syria, at heroic effort, defeated U.S. attempts to overthrow the government. But the sanctions, which would enable absolutely normal trade and rebuilding, are attempting to strangle Syria, as they are attempting to strangle Iran and the whole region, because it shuts down any relations between each of the countries of the region. And that's what it's also meant to do, to push back development, to push back solidarity. And I don't think it's going to have that impact. I think it will, if anything, harden, toughen the resolve in Syria and in Iran, in Iraq too. So the U.S. has shown that their aims, they can be pushed back by people's mobilizations. They have been pushed back. U.S. was literally pushed out of Iraq by millions of people, by real effort, pushed out of Syria. But they keep trying. They really, it's relentless, and it's criminal. And as I say, it has to be the countries of Europe and here in the U.S. which demand a stop of this criminal activity.
Daniel Kovalik.
It shouldn't be only the people of Syria and Iran speaking on this. Really, the people of the whole world need to denounce this.
Let's go over to Pittsburgh again. Daniel Kovalik, the Russian foreign minister, said that the U.S. military is present on Syrian soil illegally and in violation of all norms of international law. China has warned against any action that would further complicate the situation in Syria. An analyst that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV said that Washington might be intending to relaunch the war on Damascus, the one that Biden's old partner Barack Obama started. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that's a great danger. And again, that the Democrats and frankly, the more liberal media, for lack of a better word, have signaled that that's what they want for years. I mean, the Democrats and, outlets like New York Times, NPR, were constantly attacking Trump for every position he took, which is fine. I mean, I have no problem with that. But the one thing they would applaud him for is when he bombed Syria. They were clear that that's what they want, more bombing. They made it clear they didn't want Trump to get out of Afghanistan like he was actually seeming to try to do. So, yeah, I think this is the plan. I think that the goal is to destroy Syria. The U.S. government has on a few occasions acknowledged they cannot overthrow Assad. And so clearly the goal is simply to destroy the country. And now the last figure I saw is you have 12 million Syrians who are starving due to the sanctions, the Caesar sanctions. So I think they are going to continue to sow chaos and destruction in the Middle East. And I say that very sadly, but that's what I see happening.
Sarah Flounders, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, he recently said that Moscow had received unconfirmed information that the United States is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. How inconsistent has the U.S. been in its policy in Syria? Many believe it's impossible to predict whether the U.S. will stay or leave.
Well, the U.S. policy has been consistent in terms of war on the world. And in that, they are signaling that they plan to continue that relentless war. And it is also a war that is absolutely destroying the U.S. We have the highest by every count of deaths from COVID because there is no health infrastructure. There's a huge military infrastructure. They know what's on every one of 800 military bases around the world. They know they can, with their satellites, monitor everything, and yet they can't get out vaccines in the U.S. They can't give emergency supplies in the midst of a horrendous cold snap that's hit Texas and parts of the U.S. South, and people are freezing without electricity, without heat. They can't provide those things. They can't provide the most basic things here for the population. And they can't provide vaccines for the global South, for the people of the world, or the people of the U.S. But they can provide bombs. They can provide destruction, because that is profitable. And that's how they calculate it. They don't calculate it at all with people need peace, and they need health care, and they need good food. Those are absolute human needs. And instead, this policy is set by those who profit from war, and it's enormously profitable, billionaires. So it's destructive, and really those links need to be made more and more so that people here in the U.S. understand who's responsible when they don't have heat or jobs or a vaccine. Who's responsible? This government that cares more about war.
Daniel Kovalik, the attacks in Iraq supposedly against U.S. targets, which have often had little impact, they've escalated over the past year, especially since the Iraqi parliament passed a law that mandated a full withdrawal of all foreign troops from the country. Many are saying that the rise in such activities are apparently aimed at creating a sense of insecurity in Iraq and providing a pretext for the U.S. to keep its troops and forces in the country. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, yeah, so though it's a strange argument, right, it's a circular argument, to be in a country illegally like the U.S. is, and then to say when, you know, national forces then attack them because they want them out, as we would in the U.S. if someone invaded us and stayed for years, and then to say, well, we have to stay because our presence is causing this reaction, but we have to stay to counter that reaction. It makes no sense, but that is U.S. military policy. We create the crisis, and then we stay to stomp out the crisis or to claim to. It's just completely irrational to any, honest thinking person.
Sarah Flounders, I see you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, it's true. Any thinking person would say this is a criminally insane policy, and we're paying with lives in Syria, with lives around the world, and with lives here, at all that is not being done in order to continue a war on the world. I just can't say how even disheartening, not that I had any expectation about Biden or the Democratic Party, but there was a certain expectation that there would be maybe even some breathing room, or that there would be some attention to the needs here. But it's really clear that they intend to keep military presence every single place they can, and to expand it, to threaten other countries. And so when Biden sends a message like this, we got to take it seriously and up the demands here, because that is the only way I can see, and to absolutely state how there's no excuse. We have to make this completely unacceptable, and to demand they end the sanctions and the bases and the bombings and the war on the world.
I'm going to stay with you, Ms. Flounders. Over the years, there have been numerous reports about the infiltration of Daesh elements from Syria into Iraq under the protection and logistical assistance of U.S. troops, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and its affiliates, which have been integrated into Iraq's regular forces. They're deployed on the Syrian border, and they're helping the army to stem the movement of the terrorists between the two countries. Do you think maybe that's why they're being targeted by the U.S.?
Well, certainly the U.S. wants to continue to use Daesh forces. They want to use everywhere they can the most reactionary forces who only seek to destroy. And in the same way that their alliances are with completely criminal monarchies who don't represent the population, such as Saudi Arabia. So it's not surprising that they would use Daesh, ISIS forces in Iraq, in Syria, and used as a threatening force in other countries of the world, and then it gives them an excuse to say they're going in to fight these forces. Well, maybe folks bought that back in 2014 and 2015, but I don't think anybody accepts that any longer. They know who pays and who transports these forces, who protects them in supposed prisons, and then moves them out in order to carry out destruction again.
Sure. One last question for Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh, Syria's new permanent representative to the UN, Bassam Sapor. He stressed that the politicization of the Syrian humanitarian crisis has increased the suffering of people in the war-ravaged country, and Western sanctions against his country have prevented Syrians from acquiring their basic commodities. Why are Syrians being collectively punished by Western countries, namely the U.S.?
Well, this is standard operating procedure. Many countries are being punished. Many populations are being punished by the West, and in particular by the U.S., because they are standing firm against U.S. aggression, against U.S. intervention, against U.S. imperialism. And when you do that, you're punished. That is how it goes. That's how the U.S. has operated since its inception. That is the nature of the beast, unfortunately.
All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guest, Professor of International Human Rights, Daniel Kovalik, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to a national co-director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, joining us from New York. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
Thank you.
Good night.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the assassination of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, according to a new intelligence report that the Biden administration released on Friday, 26th of February, that offered the world a reminder of the brutal killing. The article that you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Julian Barnes, David Sanger, Mark Mazzetti, Michael Crawley, and Michael LaForgia. The piece is titled Saudi Crown Prince is Held Responsible for Khashoggi Killing in U.S. Report. Stay with us for more. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the assassination of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, according to a new intelligence report that the Biden administration released on Friday, 26th of February, that offered the world a reminder of the brutal killing. An elite team of operatives helped carry out the killing, the report said. The team reported directly to Prince Mohammed, who cultivated a climate of fear that made it unlikely for aides to act without his consent, according to the report. It omitted the brutal details of Mr. Khashoggi's death, including the dismemberment of his body with a bone saw after Saudi officials lured him to their consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. But the Biden administration took no direct action against Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, instead announcing travel and financial sanctions on other Saudi officials involved in the killing and on members of the elite unit of Royal Guard who protected the Crown Prince. The Biden administration concluded it could not risk a full rupture of its relations with the Saudi kingdom, relied on by the United States to broker peaceful relations with the Israeli regime. Cutting off Saudi Arabia could also push its leaders towards China. Lawmakers of both parties praised the release of the report, but some Democrats, including Representative Adam Schiff of California, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, spoke out in dismay that the administration stopped short of more severely punishing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for killing of Mr. Khashoggi. Khashoggi was a legal permanent resident of Virginia who was critical of the Saudi government in the columns that he wrote for the Washington Post. There are ways to bring about more personal repercussions without completely rupturing the relationship, Adam Schiff said in an interview. Adam Schiff added, "This is an official U.S. government statement that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has blood on his hands, and that blood belongs to an American resident and journalist, and I think that's very powerful." The 2018 assassination of Jamal Khashoggi and the brutality of his death, detailed in news reports at the time, shocked the world. And it disgusted American officials, including the CIA director at the time, Gina Haspel, according to current and former intelligence officials. Gina Haspel and other American officials listened to a recording obtained by Turkish intelligence that not only captured Jamal Khashoggi's struggle against Saudi agents and his killing, but also the sounds of the bone saw being used on his body. The Saudi government issued a blistering response to the report's release and the penalties, rejecting the document as a negative, false, and unacceptable assessment about its leadership. "It is truly unfortunate that this report, with its unjustified and inaccurate conclusions, is issued whilst the Saudi kingdom had clearly denounced this heinous crime," the statement said. It noted that the kingdom had taken steps to prevent a repeat of the killing. It prosecuted 8 people in connection with the murder. Much of the evidence the CIA used to conclude that Prince Mohammed bin Salman was culpable in Jamal Khashoggi's killing remains classified. But the report's disclosure was the first time that the American intelligence community had made its conclusions public, and the declassified document was a powerful rebuke of the Crown Prince, a close ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose continued support of him prompted international outrage. The release of the report signaled that President Joe Biden, unlike his predecessor, would not set aside the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, and that his administration intended to try to isolate the Saudi Crown Prince. We assess that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved an operation in Istanbul, Turkey, to capture or kill Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, said the report, issued by Mr. Biden's Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines. The decision to rebuke the Saudis without punishing Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman directly was the result of a weeks-long debate among aides to President Biden, who during the 2020 presidential campaign called Saudi Arabia a pariah state with no redeeming social value. 2 years earlier, Joe Biden called out the Trump administration for its inaction after Jamal Khashoggi's death, calling it embarrassing and dangerous. President Biden's newly formed national security team advised him that he could not bar the heir to the Saudi crown from entering the United States, nor weigh criminal charges against him, without breaching the relationship with a key Arab ally, according to officials. They said that a consensus emerged inside the White House that the cost of such a breach in terms of Saudi cooperation was simply too high. For Joe Biden, the decision was a telling indication that his more cautious instincts had kicked in. In an interview with Univision on Friday, 26th of February, President Biden said that he spoke yesterday with the Saudi king and not the crown prince. Mr. Biden added that he had made it clear to him that the rules are changing and we're going to be announcing significant changes today and on Monday to hold the Saudis accountable. It is outrageous what happened. Ultimately, the Biden administration announced penalties against Saudi officials, including a travel ban and freezing of assets of the kingdom's former intelligence chief, and sanctions against members of a paramilitary unit that took part in the assassination. The U.S. State Department also announced visa restrictions against 76 Saudi nationals accused of suppressing or harming journalists, activists, and dissidents. And more will be eventually be applied to others around the world as the administration expands enforcement of a new Khashoggi ban, the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said. The relationship with Saudi Arabia is bigger than any one individual, Anthony Blinken added on Friday at a news conference at the U.S. State Department. Blinken said, "What we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to calibrate it to be more in line with the interests and our values." Dennis Ross, a former Middle East negotiator and foreign policy aide in administrations of both political parties, applauded Joe Biden for trying to thread the needle, calling the matter a classic example of where you have to balance your values and your interests. "We are now doing things that show a clear difference with the previous Trump administration on democracy and human rights," Dennis Ross added. The four-page intelligence report contained few previously undisclosed major facts and reiterated the CIA's conclusion from 2018 that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. It made its case based on smaller pieces of evidence and the CIA's understanding of the Crown Prince's control of the Saudi kingdom, which intelligence officials have long said led him to a high confidence conclusion of his culpability. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman viewed Jamal Khashoggi as a threat and broadly supported using violent measures if necessary to silence him, the intelligence report concluded. American intelligence agencies learned that Saudi officials had planned an unspecified operation against Mr. Khashoggi, but the report said the United States has not learned when the Saudi officials decided to harm him. Members of the hit team flew to Turkey on 2nd of October 2018 after Saudi officials lured Jamal Khashoggi, who was seeking paperwork to marry his Turkish fiancée, into the consulate building in Istanbul. While the team arrived in Istanbul prepared to kill Jamal Khashoggi, American intelligence agencies were not confident that was their only authorized option. The spy agencies could not rule out that Prince Mohammed bin Salman might have preferred to capture Mr. Khashoggi, an American intelligence official said, adding that the CIA and other intelligence agencies have high confidence in their judgment that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for an order to either capture or kill Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi's body was never found. According to the report, Prince Mohammed fostered an environment where his aides feared that any failure to follow his orders could result in their arrest. This suggests that the aides were unlikely to question Mohammed bin Salman's orders or undertake sensitive action without his consent, the report said. The report listed 21 individuals involved in the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, including members of a hit team. The operatives worked for the Saudi Center for Studies and Media Affairs, at the time led by Saud al-Qahtani, a close advisor of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Mr. Al-Qahtani's official job was the media czar for the royal court, and he was once in charge of the campaign to use social media to attack Saudi dissidents online. The report noted that Mr. Al-Qahtani had said publicly that he did not make decisions without the Crown Prince's approval. The report said that 7 members of Prince Mohammed bin Salman's elite protective detail, called the Rapid Intervention Force, or RIF, were part of the 15-man team that murdered Jamal Khashoggi. The unit has carried out a campaign of kidnapping, surveillance, detention, and torture to crush opposition to the Saudi royal family. Members of the RIF, or the Rapid Intervention Force, would not have participated in the operation against Khashoggi without Mohammed bin Salman's approval, the declassified report said. From the moment Mr. Khashoggi's death was discovered, Saudi officials sought to deflect blame from the Crown Prince. The Saudi government imprisoned 8 people in connection with Mr. Khashoggi's death, trying them largely secretively. Though 5 were originally sentenced to death, after one of Mr. Khashoggi's sons said he and his siblings had forgiven the men who had killed their father, a Saudi court reduced the sentences to prison terms. Adam Schiff, the Democratic representative from California, said he met with White House officials on Friday, 26th of February, to press for more personal repercussions on the Saudi Crown Prince. "I don't think the president should be meeting with him. I don't think the president should be talking with him," Mr. Schiff said. "I think the administration should explore ways to go after assets that he controls." Ahead of the report's release, President Joe Biden spoke to King Salman of Saudi Arabia, and officials have said President Biden will speak only with the king, his counterpart as head of state, though others in the administration might speak directly to the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Representative Tom Malinowski, a Democrat from New Jersey, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Obama administration, said a visa ban for Mohammed bin Salman should be mandatory under existing law if the Secretary of State has credible information that he committed a gross human rights abuse, which the Secretary of the State just told us that he has.
Good morning! morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.